Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. Here we are, we're having another walk down the old railway track in Wolverhampton, and we've been having a very meandery conversation about imagination. So we thought we'd record what we've been talking about, and Pete's just started telling me about philosophical imagination.
Yeah. I've got this unrespectable idea that there is such a thing as a philosophical imagination.
Why is it unrespectable?
Well, in some senses, or, you know, in some instances, philosophers try to understand themselves and the world by bracketing out imagination, or I don't know, suppressing it or something like that, but by taking it out of the operation, because it's suspicious, you know, because imagination creates in the mind entities that don't really exist.
Yeah.
You know, like hobbits and orcs and all that kind of stuff, you know.
So they're not very keen on that then?
Well, it's a bit of a yes and a no, really. I think there's a lot of ambivalence. I suppose philosophical imagination manifests as speculation, doesn't it? You know, and there's been a lot of speculation in philosophy over the last couple of millennia, east and west, for that matter. You know, it's something that kind of goes on in most places. And when you speculate, you do something like using the imagination to build a narrative explanation of some phenomena around you. For instance, the passage of day into night and night into day. At some point, that was collectively apprehended as a mystery. And when there's a mystery, the human beings always seek explanation. It's just something we do. And so a story comes about, you know, about about the sun god riding his chariot across the sky and all this kind of stuff, you know. So that's what speculation is, and it's been intimately tied with philosophy ever since. But at the same time, there's always been the opposite force, which is scepticism, which is the unwillingness to subscribe to any kind of dogma, you know, the suspicion against stories and against speculative explanations. Of course, we see this in Socrates, you know, with his relentless questioning. And with his game of dialectic, in which he attempted to expose the beliefs of his interlocutors as kind of impossible to justify. Of course, this is a tendency that got him killed, you know.
Yeah.
So you've got this opposite force as well. You could say philosophy is pulled, you know, by wonder towards speculation, and by scepticism away from speculation, and there's a kind of a dynamic there, which has driven things along, you know, culturally speaking, a couple of thousand years. But it's the scepticism that's kind of intensified, I think, to this juncture, and the speculation which has become less and less respectable. That has been the direction in the struggle between scepticism and wonder, or scepticism and imagination, if you like. It's been scepticism that's accrued the most force to it. I mean, and as great a philosopher as David Hume in the 18th century, you know, was a Pyrrhonian sceptic, and was prepared to say, well, we know nothing, really. he couldn't even pin down causality to anything other than just kind of habit. So you might ask, well, how did he manage? Well, he would talk about being almost dizzy with his own nihilism, you know, with his inability to find justification for even the most common sense things, as I said, like causality. But it would make him dizzy, he said. But then he'd go to the club and drink some sack, which is like a dry wine that they like, sort of dry sherry or something, and play a game of billiards, and he'd actually forget all about it and feel everything was kind of quite hunky-dory,
yeah,
despite the fact that nothing is true. Actually, in that he's repeating the, to some extent, the lifestyle of Pyrrhonius, who's the chief skeptic, an ancient Greek of around two centuries before the Common Era. And he had this kind of, you know, pure scepticism, which doubted everything. And people thought he'd be incapable of managing, but he was famous for his ataraxia. That's a word that means a kind of settled contentment, quietness, you know. And he said, well, I just take things at face value from the point of view of practicality, you know. And I go about my life quietly, and I don't get disturbed by the passions of fanaticism, and, you know, and the doubt that will always hover over dogma, you know. So you can see, I mean, right the way back there to Pyrrhonius, you've got this push and pull. I mean, Pyrrhonius wouldn't believe in the gods because, well, it's speculative. It's just imagination. And as we know, imagination is simply the capacity of the human mind to create coherent worlds, even, but which have no bearing, or very little bearing, on reality.
When we were talking before, we were talking about the uses of imagination, boundaries,
how, when you start
to use your imagination and you're not frightened to do it and you start to play with the boundary lines, the kind of uses that can be put to.
Yeah. Now, I think if you take a line, like I do very often, but not consistently, I suppose, but very often, that objectivity, in inverted commas, is something that you gain by entertaining as many perspectives on a matter as you can. That matter might be the world, it might be the nature of life, it might be the nature of self. But you go for perspectives, you try and look at it from all angles. And then you don't necessarily synthesise those different perspectives, but you allow them to coexist, you know, in some kind of way, and that kind of composite coexistence of different perspectives on a puzzle or a matter of concern is what objectivity is, you know. That's basically like Nietzsche's notion of perspectivism, which he kind of sees as a critical mechanism, you know, as a critical tool for understanding life, the universe, and everything. Perspectivism, and I go along with that, I think, mostly, you know, and it's certainly the way I just find myself working anyway, you know, is to circle the object.
Yeah.
But there's a way of gaining different perspectives. And that way is to use the philosophical imagination down at the level of the boundary. Now, if like me, you want to start as far back as you can. Do you know what I mean? You want to start in the most fundamental and basic way that you can. Deep down as you can. For your starting point, for where you're going to actually enter into the attempt to understand something.
Yeah.
And the first thing that you find, I keep saying this, you know, is that everything changes. And the way to understand that incessant flux, that Heraclitean flow of everything, is to understand that it's a swirling, constantly changing kaleidoscopic pattern of lines. And those lines are what we would call boundaries. But they're shifting all the time. And the boundaries exist in the world, like that. There's nothing permanent, nothing fixed, you know, but nevertheless as lions, that we, as practical creatures, need to utilise. So that's the first thing, you know, so you've got this idea of reality as flux, and we apprehend flux as the shifting pattern of lines. Now that pattern of flux is microcosmic and macrocosmic. That's our understanding is like that. The concepts that we use are bounded by shifting lines. Just as much as the world, as this field and this water here now is a pattern of shifting lines in the macrocosm. So our cultural and conceptual universe, collectively and individually, is also a matter of flux. That means that you, as an imagination, can play with those lines, you can shift them around to see what happens when. Yeah? To see what happens when. What is the world like if the sun is at the centre of the universe? And not the earth, as we've been taught by the church. What would it look like? Let's do the calculations. Oh, we've done the calculations. Maybe we can test this hypothesis by making some predictions and seeing if they come true. So that's actually science, isn't it? That's hypothetico-deductive science. But you notice that the imagination is in there. And you can say, well, what happens if, you could ask a question, if you're a yoga person, you might ask a question like, well, what happens if everything is moving incessantly, as the Buddha says and as Heraclitus says and as Lao Tzu says, what happens if that is the case? And thing, you know, the universe isn't just a kind of conglomeration of fairly static things or things moving in a stately pattern. What happens if, and you can entertain that, you can let that change your eyes, new way of seeing. You could say, what happens if the notion that women are inferior to men and should be ruled by them is bollocks? What happens if it's the other way around? Or what happens if there's just a totally unique and different relationship between the sexes? What happens if then? And imagine that. So, in the field of politics, I've talked about the role of utopian thinking before. Now, because utopian thinking is the philosophical imagination. But I've also pointed out how dangerous that is. And when people pursue utopias with fanaticism, that they produce hells on earth. At the same time, humanity's urge to move forward, to enhance life, isn't going to go away. So it's basic to us. And therefore, in order to do that business of managing the future and of leaving the future for our descendants, then we have to utilise utopian thinking. We have to imagine the future. Again, it's philosophical imagination. You know, even though it's also philosophical imagination, to realise that you have to handle this till with great care. Utopianism is both essential and mortally dangerous. So it takes an act of philosophical imagination to see how that is actually the wise counsel vis-a-vis utopias. So there's a few examples about how actually the kind of speculative philosophical imagination actually hasn't been ruled out of court by scepticism, but yet scepticism has showed the imagination how it can improve itself and become more reliable practically by showing us perspectivism. I mean, perspectivism actually is a way of looking at objectivity that comes out of sceptical inquiry into the nature of objectivity. And, you know, the received notion of objectivity as some kind of absolute truth is one that's prime. It's a prime target for scepticism, isn't it? It's, you know, it's one of those things that you've got to take a swipe at it. If you've got a sceptical bone in your body, is there such a thing as absolute truth? Who says? What do they get out of saying that? How would we ascertain that? How would we ascertain that a truth is absolute, absolute, absolute? How would we do that? How would we inhabit no perspective whatsoever in order to do that? You know, these are all the kind of questions a sceptic might ask of an absolutist, you know, an epistemological absolutist. And it's out of that questioning that Nietzsche came up with the idea of perspectivism. You know, I don't suppose he was the first, but he did kind of work it up a little bit, you know. And I certainly think if you are going to think about big stuff like life, you know, the universe and everything, and self, I should add, you're only going to do yourself some kind of damage, I would say, unless you can kind of think in the round. Unless you can occupy, you can imaginatively inhabit these different perspectives and then see what the lie of the land is then. Any thoughts, Professor Ingham?
So do you think there are any links between imagination and belief?
Oh yeah. Plenty of people believe in purely imaginary ideas, in purely imaginary worlds, and so forth. Plenty of people believe stories, grand narratives, which are concocted by imagination. Of course, that's what religion is, you know. Whether institutional or home-brewed, you know, this kind of stuff is a phenomenon of human life and a part of our attempt to understand our situation, who we are, where we are, what the universe is that we find ourselves in, what our consciousness is, etc. What's right, what's wrong, what happens to you when you die, what happens before you're born, all that stuff. You know, a grand narrative, you know, is never true. It's not the kind of thing that can be true. Propositions are true. Grand narratives are not true. They're neither true nor false because they're grand narratives and they're not propositions. Now, they contain propositions, some of which might be true or false, but in their totality they are exactly what they're called, you know, they're stories and narratives. And to subscribe to a story entails belief. Doesn't entail certainty. Belief, as opposed to certainty, is that which at least technically isn't completely justified. You know, there's always a possibility of doubt. In belief, of course, contains a possibility of doubt. And when you refuse to entertain any doubt about a belief that you hold, you are actually exhibiting faith, and you are being dogmatic. I mean, a dogma is a belief not a certainty or a collection of certainties, but a belief in which the possibility of doubt is suppressed, even though the possibility of doubt is actual, because the thing believed is usually a product of imagination, at least in some part. So I think that's the link between imagination and belief. Now, a while ago I was talking about understanding ourselves and the world in terms of a flux, or Buddha called it impermanence. You know, as Lao Tzu would have had it, the flow of things, or Heraclitus, you know, the river in which you cannot step twice. If you apprehend the world like that, you find that actually what your field of awareness contains is moving lines. And that's true of the inscape and the outscape. And then that's true of culture as well as individuals. And once you realise that, you can start to play with those things. They become amenable to some kind of will. And this is what we call the philosophical imagination, or the speculative faculty. And I've given some examples of that. Now, what you're actually doing there, when you start to play with those boundaries, is perspectivism. But that means entertaining various beliefs which you have produced yourself. You have produced the condition for those beliefs yourself by shifting the ontological boundaries around. And you're basically saying, well, what's it look like? What's it look like if I myself am not a thing? What does the world then look like? What do I then look like? You know, so that kind of speculative. And to find that out, you have to believe it for a while. Yeah, you entertain it. To believe is to entertain in that fashion. Of course, you're doing that. You're not, in this case, if you're not being dogmatic, you're not eradicating the doubt that accompanies the belief. You're attempting to suppress that, as you have to do for dogma and faith. Because what you're trying to do is you're inquiring, you're trying to understand. You're not bringing the inquiry to a close prematurely. Or maybe even at all, maybe you never bring any inquiry to a close. So what this means is that, you know, that you are actually using belief properly, because you're not suppressing its ineluctable partner, doubt. You're living with the doubt, but you're entertaining it for a bit, so you can get the perspective. Then you can move on to the next perspective, and what you do is you shift the parameters around. You know, you actually play with the boundaries. You cut the world up in a slightly different way. You know, you say, not particles but waves, perhaps, you know. Not an ego, but a process, perhaps. You try that. Yeah. And what you've done is you've shifted the boundaries around. You've cut the world up slightly differently, whether it's you've actually cut up the sphere of your experience in different ways to get a different understanding. But then you believe it for a bit. You entertain the belief. You use it. You get the perspective. Now you've got two perspectives. Actually, you know, you might at this point be tempted to think you can fuse the perspectives into some kind of harmonious whole. But I mean, you can actually find that your perspectives can be quite contradictory. And they're not going to be reconciled in any kind of obvious way. And I think it does become a matter of accommodating different perspectivism comes down to accommodating different perspectives, because you've believed in them for a while, and you've created them also by playing with the boundaries in the field of experience, in acts of philosophical and artistic, perhaps, imagination. And then you've got to kind of live with them without, I would say, attempting to remove the friction between them, you know, and remove the possibly antagonistic interaction between them. I think that's a part of it. I think that is a part of attempting to be, inverted commas, objective in that Nietzschean sense. So belief, yeah. Belief and imagination, absolutely in bed with each other.
That's a good term, in bed with each other. Yeah.
Not that I'm wanting to sound like a kind of a dogmatic, card-carrying religion of nature type. Yeah. I'm not, but I think he had that stuff on perspectivism is very, very interesting and worth playing with.
Yeah.
I would say that this use of the philosophical imagination can also be quite self-therapeutic if you have problems around dogmatism, because it just causes people problems, and problems around faith or loss of faith. Yeah. So, and there's so much in the world of culture that is this kind of play, again this swirling play of philosophical imagination itself, you know, of creation of concepts and destruction of concepts and interaction of concepts and the playing out of concepts and the utilisation of concepts and ideas. And, fresh imaginings, fresh speculations that can then be tested perhaps in the scientific setting or perhaps in an existential setting that you might test against life itself as it unfolds. How well does it fit?
Something I was mentioning before, that my thoughts this morning ran along the lines of this, that belief is an energy.
Ah.
That sounds a bit hippie, but it's like Sex Pistols. Anger is an energy, you know.
Yeah.
It's something that if you don't just see it as anger, you can use it as an energy for something else. So I see belief as a similar thing. And Pete said, well, what do you think? What does belief mean to you? So for me, I think belief is like a different quality of imagination.
Mm-hmm.
For me, imagination isn't just one thing. It's like a whole spectrum of things.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have parts of your imagination that would paralyze you with fear and into inaction, and other parts of the imagination which would spur you into action or prevent you, say, to say, oh no, now's the time to actually stop and pause and pull back. But belief for me can be a useful energy. Like, it's just mentioning before, if I believe that holding a particular rock will calm me down,
mm-hmm.
I'm well aware that probably that rock is just a harmless rock, the poor mm-hmm. thing. But I'm deciding, and I don't know why I can do this, I can decide to believe that that rock will calm me down if I hold it, mm-hmm. so it does.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, I can drop that belief. I feel that we can utilize the power of belief, because it is a very powerful force, without subscribing to that belief and without being entombed in that belief.
Yeah. No, I actually think you have to subscribe to the belief, but you don't turn it into a dogma. Because if you don't subscribe to a belief, you don't actually believe. You're pretending to believe, but if you're really going to inhabit the perspective, you do buy into the belief, but you don't remove the doubt that comes along with it, and you don't therefore commit to turning it into a dogma and an article of faith, and therefore get yourself ready to
go and chop someone's heads off. Chop
the head off anybody who disagrees with you.
Yeah.
And this is what you call dropping it. I mean, you are describing on a very kind of personal level of your own hygienic, medicinal management.
Yeah.
You know, of the game I described of playing with the boundaries, swirling boundaries, pushing one over a bit.
Yeah.
Pushing one over here for a bit.
My boundaries are very flexible.
Yeah. Well, the more you kind of relax into the flux of things, the more it's, you realise that it's a dance, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can be a player in that dance, you, whatever that is. a coalition of points of will to power that temporarily forms together in order to make something happen.
Yeah.
Call it what you like, you know. I mean, we know from lived experience, we try and do stuff. We try and make stuff happen.
Yeah.
We'd like to earn some money.
Etc.
You know,
nice.
You know, we're kind of thinking around some little projects to do that so that we don't starve. You know, there's all the imperatives of life impact on all of this, you know. Necessity, it's called. Food in your belly, roof over your head. A little bit of peace.
Yeah.
To meditate and think and create and enjoy. You know, some companionship. And then Bob's your auntie, then, isn't it?
Yeah. But it certainly does seem that if you use the power of belief, or the energy of belief,
mm-hmm.
And then you get stuck there, mm-hmm. believing that particular thing, mm-hmm. then.
Well, you used the word entombed.
Yes, and very. I chose that word carefully because that's what it feels like. Mm-hmm. It feels like that belief starts controlling you.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't utilise its power. It's like utilising you know.
Yeah, well, can I say something?
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that beliefs can control you and you not them is the one that's utilised by ideologues of every shade, you know.
Yeah.
That's how populations are controlled, and that's how the mob is prevented from becoming unruly and displacing those who have the power. Yeah, it's recognised in it in ideology and social control and social organisation is that belief will you know, actually be a controlling force inside people.
Yeah.
Ideology. I mean, a very interesting modern philosophical question is how does that get in there? What is the mechanism by which it gets in, you know? And I mean, it's out of that that you get kind of Freudian Marxism, really, you know, I suppose. You know, as an attempt to explain why slaves are happy with their slavery.
Yeah.
False consciousness in Marxist terms, whatever, you know. And that question arises directly out of that propensity that's long, long, long been known. If you control a population, plant a single belief in everybody's head, or as near as you can get it to a uniform belief, then you have a population that will act in uniform ways. Because precisely, as you observed, belief can take you over. It can be the driving force.
Yeah.
But it could have been put in there. You might not have created it yourself. It doesn't make you an autonomous being, does it? It makes you a robot, really.
Yeah. But I'm not sure how I would do it, how I do it, or how I'd be able to explain this to other people so that they would be able to benefit from that too.
Yeah.
Being able to utilise the power of belief, but without being... You know, being able to kind of just gently put it aside afterwards.
Yeah. A nice healthy dose of scepticism is at the outset.
Yeah.
About
but sometimes
everything.
I do it, and I know I'm doing it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when I pick up my rock, you know, I do sort of know that it's harmless rock. I just decide to believe that the rock is going to fill me full of peace and harmony while I hold it for those 10 minutes.
Look at you, man.
I know. But I have a ridiculously powerful imagination. Ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
I can put myself in imaginary situations and fully inhabit them so completely that every single bit of the emotion and the drama and everything is all inside me. And dear, it's too much sometimes. So maybe that's it.
It's a big part of being human, I think. Yeah, imagination.
Yeah. I had a lot of practice as a child. doing imaginary things.
And I think we're lucky to have arrived at a point culturally where you can play with it.
Yeah.
And it's almost like at last.
Yeah.
You know, it's had its moments, obviously, through history. You know, but and it's scepticism that's freed it. You know, scepticism has freed the imagination, and has freed the capacity for wonder.
That's a nice way of putting it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Scepticism has freed the imagination.
Yeah.
Yeah. And hopefully help people to be. So I think people can feel a bit frightened or guilty about inhabiting a different perspective for a while.
Yeah.
Or just look tasting, you know, like tasting the mind of somebody who believes a certain thing or thinks a certain way.
I mean, it's also the basis of empathy, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe that's why my empathy is so ridiculously strong as well.
Yeah. Poor devil.
Yeah. Which is not great, actually. Something I'd rather not have. Well, not in such abundance anyway. You know, when somebody walks into a room and you can just feel their anxiety.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a kind of, like a wall of sound thrumming through you. And you say, oh God, no. Back away. Be kind of nice to have that a little bit less, but hey ho. There's pros and cons to it all.
You should wear some of a suit lined in silver paper.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tin foil.
And there are people who, I don't know, there's so many things going on inside them that are painful and difficult.
Yeah.
And sometimes in order to be able to help them, you need to go in there and inhabit their perspective.
Yeah.
And I purposefully don't do that anymore because it is just... it is too painful to do that. Mm-hmm. I have enough perspectives going on in my head already. I'm a many-headed creature.
Yeah.
A very many-headed creature. I seem to grow a new one almost every day.
Yeah.
I've got enough now.
Feel like instead of putting them all inside your skull, just grow a new head and put one in one of those heads.
Yeah.
Grow them up on a column and have them some looking behind and some to the left and some to the right.
And then some of them are animal heads and snake heads and human heads and alien heads.
That's us.
Yeah.
Many heads.
Yeah.
Like a totem pole.
And every time there's a new situation in our lives, we grow a new head to deal with it. That maybe would be a composite of a few other heads, but it would be distinct in itself.
Yeah.
Yes, imagination is a strange and wonderful thing. Yeah. I think I probably haven't found out even maybe a little bit of what it can do yet. It can do more than I've even played with.
Yeah.
In fact, there's little bits that I feel are there and I could go and explore.
Well,
but I back off because they're a bit scared, they're a bit frightening.
Yeah. I mean, you're reminding me as you're talking that I've kind of overdrawn or overplayed the distinction between the imaginary and the real, you know. Because in most fields of awareness and dramas of lived experience, imagination intrudes into the world, you know, and the world intrudes into imagination. And of course, you know, imaginary creatures like hobbits, they are composites of known real things, you know. They're like a variant on a human being, which Tolkien knew about human beings because he was a human being himself.
Yeah.
But he wanted something new, but he didn't try and make something so novel that you couldn't describe it, you know. So imaginary creatures do owe something to the world. Look like a dragon. You know, is it the claws of an eagle, the scales of a fish, you know, etc.
Yeah. Closely modelled on a Komodo dragon.
The beard of a goat, and so on. And they're composites, you know. So the imaginary owes a lot to the real. But the real, as we perceive it, owes a lot to the imaginary, because our imaginations project into the world all the time.
Yeah.
You know. So the world, in a sense, is giving itself back, is giving ourselves back to us very often. So especially if you are imaginative, the world just gives you back to yourself. You know, you're walking through the mandala.
Yes.
You can treat the whole thing as a Jungian dream and analyse it in that way. Understand it purely as though it was a dream full of symbols that are telling you about your deeper self, if you want to.
And that's
there is a yoga called the Yoga of the Dream State, which incites you to do that.
That reminds me of a podcast that we're going to do about conscious dreaming, which I think maybe we could do very shortly. So yeah. If we end this one now,
yeah.
We could do our podcast about conscious dreaming, and then that could be a whole interesting thing for people to have a look at next.
Well, we hope you enjoy our rambolics, our rambustulous rambolic rambling.
And we'll speak to you again soon.